Hello, this is Roger Watson, the Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Advanced Nursing, and I'm in Edinburgh for the Royal College of Nursing International Research Society meeting 2016, which is also marking the centenary of the Royal College of Nursing and the 60th year of nursing at the University of Edinburgh. But there's also another celebration, which is 40 years of the Journal of Advanced Nursing, and I'm lucky to be here with Jim Smith, the founding editor of the Journal of Advanced Nursing. There's a little bit of background noise here because we can't find somewhere completely quiet to do this interview. I've got some questions for Jim, so I'm just going to go and meet Jim just now and get started this interview. I hope you enjoy it.
When I finished that course, was in 73, I applied for a scholarship for 15 weeks study in North America and got it. And I'd been working on this dissertation because the nursing officer role was very... there was a lot of debate about it. And I wanted to look at the preparation, how they were prepared, how they fitted into the role. And the professor agreed with this and he said it would fit in nicely. And I did the initial... the first lot of it, which was a group of 40 in Kent, which I analysed, but they needed to do much more. Well, America, I wasn't going to turn that down. He said, oh, don't worry, you can wait or whatever. And 15 weeks in North America was really extraordinary. That taught me a lot about, I was looking at nursing education, and also the clinic nurse specialist role, which was being debated at that time. Actually, I was really, really impressed with education in North America, because they got a high level of education, but also the teachers really were teaching the nurses in practice. And sometimes, I mean, I met an obstetric tutor who apologised for being asleep at 9 in the morning because she'd been up all night, because that was the only way the students would get that particular experience. And the other thing is, I made a lot of useful contact. The clinical nurse specialist role, there were mixed reactions. Some of them said, oh, it's dead. I observed some of them in practice. I used to say to nursing students, give a clinical nurse specialist. Oh, yes, it's the woman who's behind that door there. I said, well, we never see her. But there was one place, when I was talking about last night, Beth Israel. That really, and there were some places like that where they really were immersed in practice, recognised as experts by their other colleagues and also by medical staff. But the other interesting thing is, as I went into the universities, there wasn't a lot of doctors. And there's one big reservation I have about American education is there's no external examiner.
Nope, that's right.
Including at master's and doctoral level, which horrified me. And I have to say, it horrified some of the faculty, who, particularly if they were in significant roles, who shared with me. They said, you know, it's very embarrassing, because they're desperately trying to get me on the final committee, because that'll give it more respect. But I actually, you know, I don't believe in what they've done, and in no way am I going to be forced to, you know, that kind of thing. And the same with master's programmes. But I read dozens and dozens of master's theses, and I was amazed how often Nursing Times and Nursing Mirror were cited. And you know, in those days they were neither refereed or whatever. So I thought, it's extraordinary that it obviously indicated lack of literature. And then I spoke to some of the faculty, because, you know, their tenure committees, they have to publish in New York University when their 14 had just been given notice because they hadn't met the requirements of the tenure. They said, you know, if we're writing papers, it's taking up to 3 years to get them published. So I made a mental note of this. And then when I came back, in 73, I was Betty Raybould, who was the director of nurse education, phoned me up and said, oh, Blackwell, well, I didn't know anything about, have asked me to write a textbook or guide for nurse teachers. Would you prefer to do a chapter? I can't remember which chapter it was. I said, oh, that's fine. So I had that to do. Then Church in Livingstone came along to see me.
It's time to retire.
Because somebody who had been a colleague at Battersea knew me. They wanted someone to write a sociology textbook for nurses. And came along to ask me about that. And tentatively, I agreed to take it on. And I thought, well, you know, I've got this dissertation to do. It did have a happy ending. I didn't get the master's, but in fact, the way the course was geared, you could get a postgraduate diploma. So I didn't do that altogether. Then, I think it was early December in 1973, a young guy called Robert Lomax phoned me up. He said, oh, Blackwell's are opening an office in London, and I'm the new manager. I can hear you're writing a checkbook, a chapter for this textbook. Would you mind if I come up and see you? So he did, and we had a long chat. And then he said, I actually told him about the textbook that I was about to write. And he said, are there any gaps in the literature that you feel? Because they wanted to go in. And I said, well, this is an idea I have had about having a scholarly journal. I didn't talk about learners or academic, a scholarly journal that would publish scientific, philosophical, and other information. Because I said, certainly in North America, there are a lot of people screaming to get papers published. There's no opportunity. Well, he said, how interesting. He said, he said, you need an editorial board. Oh, I said, that's no problem. Because, you know, all of us who struggle to be getting degrees and whatnot. He said, Dr. Leonard Listown, oh, he said, that's right. He said, but you need overseas advisors. I said, oh, that's no problem. I should also add that in the second year of my degree course, I got a scholarship from the National Forest and Nightingale Memorial Committee for 10 weeks in Scandinavia. So I had a lot of international contacts. And so he said, oh, well, you know, can you identify 10? So I did. So he went, he said, now, what I'd like you to do is to write, put in writing the kind of things we've been discussing with your aims and objectives and these identified people. He said, and I'd like to think about it. And at the beginning of January 1974, he said, the managing director, Per Sargon, would like to see you. He said, I've shared it with him, he's interested. So I was taken down to Oxford to meet Per Sargon. And it was a Danish man. Very, very nice. And he said, you know, we really are interested. He said, and I think we'd like to go ahead with this. He said, but I've been obviously making inquiries from two significant people, one of whom was G. McFarlane. And the other, who was then the director of education at the RCN. I didn't make a note of her name, but I got that. Miss Rule, right, who was the director of education. He said, I shouldn't do this, but I'll read the letters to her. Well, Jean McFarlane, in glowing terms, he said, this is a man that you that you need to watch for the future, you know, da 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 da. Miss Rue said, yes, she commended me and whatnot. But she said, I think as this is an important new venture, you really would be better advised to advertise for them. So I didn't comment. And he said, when I'm telling you, we want you.
Yep.
He said, but we must be democratic about this. He said, I'm not going to force you on the profession, but we'll deal with this. He said, can you contact these people who identified as an editorial board? Ask them if they're interested. He asked me what my criteria are. I said, well, we need one person for... So there is a representative from each of the countries in the United Kingdom. and a representative of education, nursing service management, and also nursing specialties. So we had district nursing, health visiting, occupational health nursing, general nursing and so on. So there was a mix of academic and practice, and also there was somebody that represented, it so happened that people met two or three criteria, registered nurse for the mentally handicapped, or whatever they call them in those days. He said, well, write them to them and see if they're interested. And if they are, then call a meeting. He didn't call it a board meeting then. Well, of course, they're all united to come. So I always remembered, and he said, you know, he was introduced, warm and whatnot. He said, and obviously the first thing we must do, he said, is to appoint an editor. He said, so I'd like to take nominations. So I think, I can't remember, it was certainly two of my friends who nominated me. He said, and can I have some other? And there was no comment. Well, he said, Jimmy, looks as if you've been elected. And but he did say, he said, but one editor, he said, that's a lot of power. So he said, I think we probably need to elect a chairman of the board. And Jack Hayward and we used to have an independent chairman. So that was that. And then I was given the commission to solicit a number of papers for the first issue. And I think we met again. That was beginning said later. Now, I got the chapter off the Betty Rabel's book. I'd signed the contract with Church of Livingstone. Agreed. With Blackwell's, I never had a formal contract. Mm-hmm. It was all just got a letter saying congratulations, whatever. But I did. I knew that they were. I believed it would be a success. But I said to them, you know, you're using my expertise and my contact, so I need to be recompensed. And so I established a pattern of payment that took me in very good ground. I did very well. And advice I've always been given to people, don't undersell yourself for glory. You know, the glory and the pain is important. So all this was happening already in March of 2004. And then, you know, they were planning for the
1974.
The reorganisation of the National Health Service, yes. Integrating community and health services, and the deputy administrator, who became the chief administrator in the reorganisation in the Hammersmith, said, "You know, Jim, you really should apply for it." I said, oh, I love education, as you do, and whatnot. And I said, you know, that. He said, well, nothing to lose. So I did apply, and I got one. Oh, but they only start at 8. I said, there are agencies. I said, just buy 2 hours of nursing education. And so, as I say, sometimes, and that was my experience over and over again, without increasing cost, the solution. I'm probably boring.
No,
but I'm really
big. Fascinating. But,
some of the excitement of my life. And during that time, I was preparing to launch a Journal of Advanced Nursing in 1976, and writing this blasted text for Church of Livingstone, which I tried to delay, and they said, "All right, we'll give you another few months." But finally, I met, because Chris Chapman was writing one at the same time, and they said, "We want to be the first." You know. So in fact, I've lived it, as you from a little patient, people say there isn't time.
Yeah.
Anyway, we solicited the papers. During the time we solicited the papers, even those early papers were refereed,
yes.
And we had to not to my embarrassment, we had to reject one.
Yes.
And one couldn't do it for some reason. But nevertheless, we got a number, and we put it together, and it, there was wonderful paper. There was lots of space, and there was paper, nothing to be too expensive. So we no double columns or anything. And so we launched in February 1970. We had a problem with the printers, actually, initially. But we launched in the Royal College of Nursing headquarters in February. And I remember at the board meeting initially before that, just before that, papers weren't coming in dramatically, although we'd had lots of them. And I remember Margaret Scott Wright said, "Do you think we've been overambitious? Maybe we should have stuck to a quarter." Yes, so I really will. Really. And my speech, I mean, the champagne was flowing on that occasion. So I don't know whether mine came out of gibberish, but I remember saying, you know, we're delighted and all the rest of it. All the great and the good came. All over the United Kingdom. It's massive. They really were genuinely excited. And I said, I'm thrilled to tell you that already the next two issues are going to bed. What I didn't say is, there's nothing after that. But in the end, it all fell into place. And then eventually we increased the number of the papers, and then we went monthly, and then eventually we went two volumes per year. And so when I retired, there were 30 volumes. And of course, we changed the organisation and brought in other people. But I did for 20 years. It was me and a part-time sub-editor, and I happen to be blessed with a very good personal assistant.
I think no, you have. You're addressing the question before I get from Jim. I'm just a bit worried about the background noise and also the fact that we'll be flooded by people coming for tea in a minute. But I mean, you've outlined your aims and you've described the process of how long it took to get there. It was a good couple of years to get there.
The most enjoyable aspect was, normally this publisher says, now when we launch a journal, it takes 7 years before it breaks even. After 3 years, they made history.
Yes.
It's a broken evening, and we went into profit.
Incredible.
So that really won it. Yes. And then the wonderful thing is the way the circulation
went. Yes.
And the other thing is, for me, I got lots of invitations to go and speak nationally and abroad. And
that's one of the main reasons I do it.
Yeah. And certainly, as I was in the hot seat in the NASA, a real hot seat in the National Health Service, it was a blessed relief sometimes to change the focus of what I was doing and focus on papers. I think St. Augustine said, another way to relax is just to change the focus of your attention, and it worked for me. I always just have a pile of papers in my office, and if I just wanted a break, I'd read them.
I think you've really answered most of the questions, but I would like to put the one about what was your main aim for JAM? What was the thing you were really trying to do? You mentioned the gap that was there because people didn't really have anywhere to publish, but you know, what did you see
for
the future?
Well, first of all, I wanted it to be international. I didn't want it to just be a research journal. I can't remember the word that you used. And I also wanted to be useful for education, for service, and for practice. So there was a point that appealed to practices in whatever the niche was. In fact, I think I stressed philosophical discussions. So that it wasn't going to become turgid prose kind of thing. And I also stressed that it was important that the public, that the journal didn't become an end in itself, that it should be a means to, you know, enhancing the delivery of nursing over midwifery care. And I think that's one of the dilemmas. It's very hard to demonstrate. I know they have this impact factor, but that's really people who are using it for reference.
Yes.
The only feedback I've had over the years is in the when they introduced the Project 2000 courses, I was invited again to be an external examiner, and I was very impressed with the students, with some of their assignments. Mm-hmm. They were citing the Journal of Advanced Nursing. So that's the only positive feedback. Whether in fact they were implementing it. And in recent years, as a patient, I've met nursing students and also district nurses who've done undergrad and master's courses. The district nurses said it was invaluable to them, you know, when they were doing it. And the student nurses all thrilled to have met the family and assure me that it's well read.
We're getting flooded out by people coming out of the plenary sessions now, Jim. But you were
clearly, yes, I always believed it was.
Yeah, you were clearly confident.
So I'm not at all
surprised. You're not at all surprised.
I did make some notes about what I think is to do.
Yes,
the aim.
I'm going to hold this a bit closer to you so that sure we get some of this.
Yes, I think my aim is it should be an international scholarly journal that would publish scientific, philosophical and theoretical information of relevance to nursing, midwifery and health visiting, practice, education and management.
Yes.
That's what I said. Yes, I was thinking about, because the Joanna Vogel Institute in Australia,
yes.
I wrote the forward to the 10-year evaluation.
Joanna Briggs. Briggs.
And one of the problems I identified there is that even they discovered application, but it was very, very difficult. But it was a major problem.
Yeah.
And I was asking, well, how can we discover or try and rectify that to part of the journal? And one recommendation I would make, which I think you might consider, with certain studies which you could identify, that are, you know, because I'm tired of hearing ongoing studies and whatnot, and I keep asking for, after a period of 5 years, could there be some follow-up? Could you write and say, you remember you wrote, we're interested. Have you had any success in implementing the findings?
Yes.
Because I think it's important that we demonstrate that was one of our aims, and that it really is happening.
Yes.
And the other thing is too. You remember when I spoke last night, when we introduced Jan Ford?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It was to give people an opportunity of talking without any kind of academicness. I'm sad that we have no opportunity anywhere now. Nursing Mary used to have a kind of open forum where you could just write about anything you felt strongly about or that you thought was possible without the influence of any knowledge from outside.
Yes.
I spoke last night about nursing outreach. They used to have this series, This I Believe, which I found inspiring. And in fact, the science correspondence of the Times a few weeks ago, when he was talking about science generally, what he said was, science only gets you so far. It's very good at amassing observational data, but for crawling through the morass of slippery concepts, you need an intellectual compass. In other words, you need philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Professor
Rolf. Yes.
Stress that. And it's philosophy we need. I mean, when I go back and read Notes on Nursing by Franz Fatigan, that was an idea.
Mm-hmm.
Virginia Henderson, the basic concept of nursing, you know, which financed by a wonderful idea. Annie Goodridge, who founded the Yale School of Nursing, her collection of papers is based on her ideas. We do need something of that to take, to direct people in a different direction, so they're thinking independently of all these masses of influences. Because there might be gems that are still to come out. I mean, Virginia Henderson, on her earlier work, which I actually read last week, that wonderful publication, she actually took it one further. And her classic textbook, it's classical, where it, you know, it's about that thing, I don't know if you've seen it. And
Elizabeth Hopper's definition of nursing is a mix of all these various sciences, the uniqueness lying in the mix, which I took up in a textbook that I got a number of co-authors, and I tried to illustrate that in a different clinical setting, like health visiting or acute nursing, that mix would be quite different according to the situation. And what I would like is to see something like that. But I think it's this follow-up. We can't go on now, 40 years into it, without questioning, are we having any impact on care delivery in all its settings? And I would think, maybe you don't need to wait 5 years, maybe three more appropriate.
Yes.
And you can start by going
back.
Well,
we've got 40 years worth of papers to look at and consider.
Some people the Scandinavian studies, they were implementing almost as they were doing their doctorate. I mean, the first Akinsanya Award, I know that you were, that midwife, beautiful.
Yep.
All the science was there, and yet, she implemented it in that booklet for mothers, advice for breastfeeding, again bringing biological sciences into it. You know, that's what we need to foster. And so that's the challenge for the next 40
years. Well, Jim, I'll see if I can live up to the challenge. You've always had ideas for me.
Gibberish is coming out there.
No, I don't think there's any gibberish there, but we'll certainly... get a lot out of this. Thanks very much for your time, and I hope I've given you a chance to say all the things that you wanted to say.
Yes, it's been quite cathartic.
I hope we haven't been drowned out with the background noise as well.
Paid for psychoanalysis.
Who said it was free?
You're learning.
Well, you taught me, Jim. So thank you very much indeed. Great.
Next, I'm going to talk to Professor Alison Tierney, who's also one of the professors of nursing at the University of Edinburgh and director of the Nursing Research Unit, and she was the editor of the Journal of Advanced Nursing immediately before me. So I've got a few questions for Alison too.
Opportunity to see the broader workings of decision making in the NHS, and also in an era when evidence-based healthcare was really influencing management thinking and service development in the NHS. And the point at which I picked up JAN was actually in 2002 when I left Edinburgh University to go to Adelaide. And I was absolutely delighted to have that opportunity because I had been so interested in the kind of introduction of JAN in 1976, the year I got my PhD. I mean, I was so acutely aware we didn't have channels for research dissemination and discussion, and the way that James Smith introduced that journal with his aspirations absolutely resonated with me. I can remember thinking, oh, that's amazing. And so JAN had been an important journal for me. And over time I had got interested in not just publishing myself, but the whole business of reporting research, dissemination and so on. And so I had a 10-year period which kind of doubled up with Adelaide and my work back in Edinburgh. And really kind of brought me more or less to the end of my working career.
Well, that was a typically modest run through your career, which has been pretty influential with nursing models and all that you did at the Nursing Research Unit in Edinburgh, and setting up programmes of research, but thanks. So I'm guessing in 1976 you never envisaged you'd be editor-in-chief of the Journal of Advanced Nursing.
I didn't have aspirations. I'll tell you what's interesting. For a girl of my age in the 60s, nobody encouraged you to think about a career, even school, and even if you were clever. The discussion was about a job,
and
for girls it was nursing, secretarial, for the clever ones teaching. And you didn't think ahead beyond getting a job, getting married. Girls didn't go to university.
So what was happening with the sexual revolution in the 60s there that obviously didn't impinge on that, or maybe it didn't make it to Scotland?
think things did change just, yeah. you know, very much yeah. absolutely in my lifetime. Yeah. And the 60s were an interesting period of, I suppose, not that far post-war, if you think about it, but a real sense of things changing. Yeah. And that's why I think for nursing there was that opportunity in that time.
So when you took over Jan, it was already pretty successful. I mean, it was already recognised internationally, for sure. But what did you want to do to it when you took over Jan? What did you think was you're going to be the contribution you'd make?
I did have some clear thoughts about it when I started. And they were really, I suppose, reflected in the strapline that I introduced right at the beginning of my period there, which was about quality, relevance and impact. And I think that actually was a very useful triad of ideas to give a bit of guidance. The journal definitely needed to be brought a bit more up to date in terms of quality of reporting. I mean, there's a distinction, you know, the distinction between quality of research and quality of reporting. But by that time, I suppose I was well enough read to realise that quite a lot of what we were publishing in the name of research in nursing journals, including Jan, was not complete in its reporting. There were often omissions about sampling and details that weren't there. And Christine Webb was sub-editor at that time, and which was a great advantage because Christine had a real interest in the detail of the content. And so that was an agenda that she picked up with me, and we did do quite a lot of looking back, identifying where the kind of weaknesses were in the reporting, and building those into much more detailed guidelines for Jan, which were greeted with some ambivalence. I think for people who understood what we were doing, that was straightforward. For less experienced authors, they found it over-controlling, over-prescriptive, so it was an interesting kind of tussle there in a way. So that was one thing about quality. The other thing was about relevance. You know, I think already by that time I had a general feeling, not just about Jan, but in general, about what Gary was talking about today. Lots of bricks. But what were we building, you know, to use his analogy? And so that was when I looked around. The BMJ was a journal, British Medical Journal, which I liked in terms of its the way it communicated to practitioners. And the BMJ is for doctors, and doctors read the BMJ, and that always intrigued me. And so they had started doing things like requiring papers to make statements about what this paper adds, you know, what's already known about this topic, what does this paper add? And I introduced with them Richard Smith's agreement that requirement into Jan papers. How successful it was, I don't know, but I think it made people think.
Other journals like IGNS have followed suit.
And actually it's now regarded as good practice in journal publishing. So, and that was really about relevance. It was about trying to get authors to think about, you know, what is this contributing to, I suppose, nursing knowledge. So that was the other area. And impact, I, of course, was beginning to understand because of the research assessment exercise, the importance of publications in terms of their impact. And, you know, impact factors were not quite such a big deal then, but they were there. Jan was jogging along in the top 10. I understood as time went on the real importance of that to the publisher, if not necessarily to the journal. And I was, I mean, you probably know that I was more content with the fact that Jan was so well read and downloaded and cited that I was less worried about impact factor. Didn't want to kind of be manipulative about trying to improve it, but was interested in the concept of impact. And, you know, I began to understand what that was about. And it's interesting that the REF now has become really concerned with impact. And that's interesting. So those were really my kind of things that I wanted to do with Jan, plus the job I had, the practical job of Jan was poised to go online. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So when I took over, everything was on paper in filing cabinets. Yeah. And first of all, we went onto an online manuscript submission process and editing process online with the authors. And then later than that, got the journal online. And I think once we started getting all of the back copies online, that became quite exciting to me. The accessibility of Jan. Decisions like open access, you know, those were things that were introduced.
Yes. Yeah, you were certainly there during a period of huge change in the publishing industry. Mm. I think it probably has never been such a big change as then, and a lot of these things are carrying on, but they're just tweaking now. You know, a little bit more of this, a little bit more of that. But that, I mean, that's very much how I saw your editor-in-chief period. It's interesting to note that I was speaking to Jim Smith earlier, and he said he left me with the challenge of trying to demonstrate the impact of the journal on clinical practice, and I'm really thinking about that, and that's one of the things that you were concerned about. I'm not sure we do that very well. Because I was looking across the fence from JCN all the time at what was going on in Jan, and we just copied what you did. It made us very successful too, but I think it was right. I think Jan was pretty much at the top of the tree. But I think it could have been quite vulnerable, as could JCN, if it hadn't gone down the road and adopted the changes that you put in.
Yeah.
And, because it's the standard now. Nobody argues about these things now. Nobody argues about Consort and Prisma. And
but I've always been good at looking outside of nursing, sideways, to see what's going on in the wider world. Yes. And it was easy for me when I began to read what was happening in the world of journals, nothing to do with nursing, that things were happening. Yes. And so I knew it was very important to be picking up on these things. Yeah. And there were lots of interesting publications in that time, like the ethics of journal publishing and all of those things. Yeah. So there were, there was lots of things to be addressed, but it was interesting to do it.
Yeah. Because what do you think? I mean, you're ticking off my questions in a sense. I mean, Web 2 and the social media coming up, that was just coming in as you were stepping down. But what was the biggest challenge, do you think, during your time there? Not necessarily of those things that you mentioned, but maybe it was one of those.
I think the biggest challenge for Jan when I was there, I think probably was converting authors to some of these newer requirements. And I think I was surprised that there was quite a lot of resistance to some of it. So when, for example, I introduced the requirement for the author contribution to be explicated, I had to deal quite often with refusals to do that. It had never occurred to me that it would be problematical for people. But it was clearly challenging for some people who didn't understand where it had come from. And I suppose those were the challenging things for me in trying to take the authorship with you, because of course you can't have a journal if you don't have authors. During my period I had a number of significant researchers in the UK who refused to send anything else to Jan because they didn't like some of these editorial policies. You know, I'm not going to name them.
I'd love you to, but
I'm sure you would love me to. But that was difficult for me because it made me worried that I was perhaps not presenting it clearly enough if people weren't understanding it. It was a little bit like the RAE. I never could understand why people couldn't get their heads around it. Because once I'd got my head around it, I did understand it. So I suppose those were the challenges for me. The kind of online stuff wasn't really challenging. That made it all much easier.
Well, I mean, I identify with that. You can be very easily not upset, and so your equilibrium can be upset, and you think, well, you know, people don't like the journal and won't submit them, because as you say, without them, you're nothing, you know. And people can be very critical of minor things. I met somebody in Saudi last week who was rather upset at the authenticate policy we have now, which is looking for similarity, and how that was handled. And I don't somehow think she realised this was just standard practice now everywhere, but I think that's the problem. I think
when you're
pioneering, you're the one that's doing it, and you think you're going to get knocked off.
So the other thing that I was found difficult and probably didn't really crack was how to engage North American nurse researchers with JAMA.
Yes.
You know, I went through a phase of going and attending conferences in the States, and I had a lot of connections, you know, in the US from kind of phase in the nursing research unit. And I was disappointed in a way that they didn't see JAM as a significant, you know, place for them to publish. And found that hard to try to find ways of explaining it, presenting it to them that would engage them.
Yeah. Yeah.
In part, I think that's their problem of being, of seeing the American published journals as being more important and not understanding that worldwide JAM has a presence.
Yes. Yeah.
So I think they were much more interested in publishing in impactful journals and in status journals and less interested in what I see publishing as about dissemination.
Yes, yeah. Oh, I still meet people in the States who haven't heard of the journal, which I find extraordinary, and you think they might know better. But you've done something right there, because shortly after I took over America, submissions from America were the highest number of submissions to the journal. So it is improving, but you'd expect, given the number of publications coming out of the States, that it would be huge, but it's just just tips the UK.
Well, appointing Jacqueline Fawcett as the North American editor, that was a really good ploy, and Blackmore was supportive of that, and that was because I felt we needed to have somebody who had access to, you know, the fellows and the groups in the US who we wanted to try to engage. So I think that was part of the reason for that. You know, less to do with me and much more to do with with Jackie.
Yes, yeah. Oh, yeah, a very high profile person in the States. Yeah. Right. Do you still read Jan?
I do. I do, interestingly. I don't read lots of other stuff.
No.
I now read any nursing literature, a bit like you were talking about yesterday, highly selectively. So I look for something, you know, to answer questions or, you know, inform me about particular aspects of things. And I began to do that when I was on the board of NHS Lothian. You know, I began to be using the literature in a kind of topic-driven way rather than, you know, as a kind of researcher feeling I was up to date with the literature. So it was much more a kind of search engine driven type of interest in the literature. But JAN's about the only journal. When I was editor in chief, like you, I read everything that was published. Every word that was published, I had read.
Yes.
I loved that because I got to really know what was being published. And it also taught me a lot about reading articles. You know, and I realised I had spent a lot of time skimming articles. So I suppose just because I got into that habit, I read JAN a bit in the same way, and I sometimes worry that I'm actually tempted to edit it.
surely not. There is somebody editing it.
Yes, I do, and I enjoy it. And,
everything can be improved. You can edit anything.
Well, always can, but I think it's good, you know, and you have a really, you know, you do have a clear hand in that. I can see that, you know, coming through. It's good quality, it's consistent, you know. I'm quite sure you do a lot of, you know, you're speedy at doing that. But no, I do read it, and I think I find it interesting to try to just, it's a way of me seeing what is going on, you know, what are the kind of fashions, because there's some, you know, you can see things, you know, kind of changing, who's publishing, where it's coming from. You know, I really like coming across papers that I do think really are saying important things, and I think, you know, that's good. I still worry that a lot of it is pretty immaterial.
Well, so do I, and I think every journal from Nature, I shouldn't say down to JAN, but down to the kind of journal that we are, worries about that, because the vast majority of papers published in every journal are never cited, which suggests that possibly that they're never read, and they certainly aren't useful enough to be passed on. I think we do depend on just the one or two papers, not just for impact, but you know, we're using the rest of them as a vehicle to get one or two really good papers out, but so it would be really good to get more
important, just important, influential.
That's what I feel. Out, yes. You know, and I think in a way, I suppose what I would say is, should you know, ask is, should Jan? I ask this question. Yeah. Should Jan be a much smaller journal?
Yes.
And
that's an interesting point.
Be
yes.
highly selective.
Yes.
And
yes.
say Jan yes. is only publishing yeah. excellent works.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's in terms purely of impact factor. That's worked for some other journals, and I probably. Somebody will do the math and prove me wrong here, but I think if we counted the number of papers published in The Lancet in a month, and that comes out weekly, it would be fewer than the papers that are published in a month in Jan. So that's worth thinking about. The publishers have certainly agreed never to, not to get bigger, because that could be very dangerous. I don't know whether they'd agree to getting smaller or not. But I think they would want to.
I had that discussion, yeah. you know, when I felt we were publishing lots of stuff yeah. that I wasn't convinced was either yes. really high enough quality or of real, yeah. you know, real
yeah.
value.
Yeah. Yeah.
On the other hand, you have to have, you know, you have to have the opportunity for early career researchers
yes.
to be publishing.
Yes.
I mean, it's
yes.
a dilemma about.
Yeah. And I think we can. I mean, I can sleep. I certainly think we can both sleep easily in bed at night. The papers didn't get in if they did reach a certain standard. I mean, that
yeah.
was,
yeah.
you know, whatever that standard was, there is a standard that they have to meet. Yeah. Well, I've never discussed with Wiley about making the journal smaller, but I think it probably needs to change. I think, all, you know, I think it might be time for Jan to look different and feel different. This will be news to the publishers that are listening to the podcast and listening to this.
I mean, one way of making
how would,
it.
How would you see
well,
it?
Well, one way of making it smaller is I'm increasingly interested in how you can exploit digital platforms, you know, multimedia kinds of platforms.
Yeah.
And I like the concept of layered content.
Yeah, yeah.
You
yes.
know, which even during my time in Jan
yes,
was beginning
yes.
to feature,
yeah.
I mean, in a kind of experimental way in some of the journals.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's what I would like to see, because I feel it might be a way of filtering out the important messages
yeah.
so that what you get at the front is a
yeah.
much shorter
yes.
yeah. version. But allowing people to tap in to the depth,
yes.
and you can take that broadly, you know,
yes.
by having links. And I suppose what I'm saying is, you know, could Jan be novel in adopting actually an unconventional, modernised format of how it publishes
yes.
nursing
yes.
research? So actually, some of it might be linking to a podcast,
yes. yeah. Yeah.
to illustrations,
yeah.
or to
yeah.
other content
yeah.
on the internet.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I suppose if I was doing it now, that's how I would be kind of
yes.
thinking. I'm very interested in how the digital world is moving. I mean, I have two children who work in that area, so I have kind of an inside view of what's happening. But, I mean, as a parallel, Sarah, daughter, works, she's in the film industry, she did have a production company, she's a producer, a documentary producer by trade, but she's gone at the moment into distribution online using various platforms, and interestingly featuring behind the scenes content. So the film, so this is a Netflix parallel for independent films, so not the big studios, which Netflix, but an independent stream. And it's the behind-the-scenes content that is utterly fascinating. Interviews with the directors,
right.
interviews with the producer,
yes.
photographs, offcuts,
yes.
edits.
Yeah.
But if you have a knowledge of film, an interest in film, utterly fascinating,
yes. Yes.
hugely informative. So you have the film,
mm-hmm.
which you can just watch and take at face value, but you have all of this,
yeah.
you know, layers
yeah.
of...
Yes.
And I suppose I have thought, you know, occasionally,
yes. yeah.
that is a model
yeah.
that,
yes.
you know, you could
yeah.
you could use.
Yes.
And the interviews
yeah.
particularly
yes.
are very interesting. You know, listening to a director talking about decisions about the film,
yeah.
you can imagine a kind of lead researcher
mm-hmm.
giving
mm-hmm.
you a kind
yeah.
of discussion
yes. yeah.
or decisions about that.
Yeah. It's interesting you should say that. I mean, we probably were. We do have podcasts on the YouTube channel, and we've got control over putting them out. And it's over selective content.
Yeah.
It's not systematic.
Yeah.
It would be nice to think that every paper could have that. Yeah.
Or maybe not. Maybe not every paper needs it.
Feature more. I think we could do it with more. But the one thing we do offer, we now ask authors to give us a press statement. Mm-hmm. It's a sort of summary that's brings up the highlights in the paper.
Which the university
which we can use. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So this goes out to publicity people if we think the paper's worth it. But we also offer authors the chance to make podcasts and YouTubes, and you could count them in one hand. This is the thing. It's somehow, it's not just having the idea, and it's not just the editors saying, slaving away and doing these things, which I think is important. It's somehow engaging the authors to feel that it's more important. Because I don't think they do. And the one or two have made the podcasts, mostly YouTube videos, they've been absolutely brilliant. You know, some have had music, some have been kind of one-minute summaries, quite innovative. One was a very relaxed interview with somebody sitting out in the garden. I just thought it just captured the paper perfectly. But again, I have five or six of these out of the 300 papers we publish a year, and we've offered this facility for nearly 3 years, you know, so I really struggle with how to get across to authors that it was important to take responsibility.
I mean, that may be partly reflecting that in nursing we may not have people who are savvy enough.
Yeah, I was just wondering if it's the subject.
And I always feel nursing is hampered as a profession sometimes by not getting up to date with some of these societal movements.
Yes.
You know, we miss out.
Yeah.
We will catch up,
but
you kind of feel, well, you know, you're wasting these years while other people, you know, when I watch in the kind of industry that my daughter's in, that's absolutely taken off, has an entirely new interest, is pulling people in, you know, who've kind of lost interest in film.
Yes.
There's a recognition that cinemas are now much less important, people don't go to the cinema.
Yes. Yes.
So the film industry to survive, and you could argue that for nursing research to survive, it's got to kind of shake itself up and say, right, you know, what are these new things?
Yes, I mean, my 7-year-old grandson can take my mobile phone and have a YouTube up before I can stop him. You know, he knows that he floods my YouTube channel with his own silly little ditties, but he can do it on my phone. He knows how to. He knows my password. He knows how to use video capture, and up it goes. And
well, here's an idea for you.
Yeah.
If nurses are not interested, put them out for the public.
Yes.
You know, there must be some papers that are published that actually the messages in them, particularly about cancer.
People could pick up and talk about the importance, and actually that would be also a way of showing impact.
Yeah.
You know, show the impact.
So
of the papers.
Are.
Yeah, there you go. You've solved the problem in one fell swoop, Alison. Do you want a job? Well, thanks very much. I mean, that's really great. That's a nice half hour. I'll edit some clips out of this and put it together with yours and Jim. I mean, I might put it all together, but try and cut out my little bits here and there. But and I'll certainly give you the link to let you listen to it. So thanks.
Oh, great.
Thanks a lot.